Chapter 9. John Murray, 1903. John Murray had never planned to go to Kelly's Island, but he had an urgent need to get out of Sandusky, and the first transport he saw was a ferry. He had no idea where it was going. He only knew he needed to get on board and stay out of sight until she sailed. The ferry headed out into the waters of Lake Erie, and before long they were out of sight of land. John was pleasantly surprised when an island rose out of the heat-hazed horizon. The little island seemed like a glittering green jewel shimmering in the August heat. As they approached the dock, John saw the sign welcoming him and informing him that he had arrived at Kelly's Island. The island felt safe, a far cry from what he had left behind in Sandusky. He saw pebble beaches and white clapboard houses, trim little pleasure boats swung at anchor in the bay. His pleasure soon gave way to disappointment. The island was too picture-perfect. Too neat, too tidy, and too conservative. It offered very little promise of income, but it would have to do for a little while. It was safer than Sandusky, not to mention Toledo, Cleveland, and a number of other communities along the lake. As he descended from the ferry, he noticed a building at the foot of the pier. It had a slightly raffish air, rather like a streetwalker sitting among a row of respectable matrons. There were red curtains at the windows, and the sound of jazz music played on a honky-tonk piano tinkled out of the doorway and across the manicured front lawns, the screened porches, and the marble birdbaths. John Murray sniffed like a dog scenting a rabbit. So there was something here, after all. The first order of business was to find a place to stay. He strolled along the island's main street, deserted in the noonday heat, and rounding a corner saw a delightful scene spread before him. It was not the bright blue water of the lake that caught his eye, nor the plume of steam from the freighter that was docking some half-mile away at the commercial dock. It was the two young girls, frolicking in the surf, that caught John Murray's attention. No doubt, by Kelly's Island standards, they were being indiscreet, and certainly they were being unladylike. But it was a pleasure to see them leaping in and out of the waves, their dresses hitched up to their waist. There was a blonde, a pretty little plump thing, and a dark-haired one, tall and lithesome. While he watched, the two girls tumbled into the water and swam about, splashing and giggling. He spread his jacket on the beach and sat down to watch them, his quest for lodging momentarily forgotten. They would have to come out eventually, and that was the sight he was waiting to see. At last, the dark one noticed him and turned to whisper to her companion. He smiled and waved. The girls, with the water up to their shoulders, stared at him shyly like two little mermaids. "Come on out," he called. "Go away," said the dark one. "Please," added the blonde. "I won't hurt you," he said. "Come on out." The girls conferred again in concerned whispers. At last the dark one said, "This is ridiculous, Cora. We can't stay here all day. I'm getting out." "Oh, Evangeline, how could you?" Cora asked. But the dark girl was already wading up onto the beach. Water streamed from her black hair, the thin white dress clung to her body, and her feet were bare. She walked right past John Murray, proceeding briskly despite the sharp stones of the beach. "Hope you enjoyed the view," she said as she passed. "Very much," he replied. She turned to face the water. "Come on, Cora," she called. "He doesn't bite." "Don't count on it," said John. He stood up and extended a hand. "John Murray," he said. "I've just arrived on the ferry, and I'm looking for a place to stay. Perhaps you could help me." "I could if I wanted to," she said. "But I don't want to. So goodbye, Mr. Murray." John grabbed her arm as she passed and treated her to his most dazzling smile. "Surely not," he said. "Surely you'll help me." "Why should I?" "Because you have a kind face," John said. "You're not looking at my face," she said. She was young and quite outspoken and may have been a match for any island boy. But she was no match for John Murray's experience. He kept pace with her as she set off along the dusty street. He laughed, he joked, he offered her the whole package of teasing seduction that he had learned at his father's knee. And before Evangeline Latimer ran up under the front porch of her home, he had obtained her promise that she would meet him later, after supper. She went inside to the coolness of the clapboard house, and he went happily to the casino to earn the money for a lengthy stay. Within days, he knew all there was to know about her simple life. She was 17, and she had never been off the island. Her father was a dockmaster at the limestone quarry, and her mother was the island's schoolteacher. They had kept their only child protected and innocent. He recognized her innocence, but he also recognized that she was desperate to lose that innocence. She needed very little persuasion. He became her summer Prince Charming as she showed him all her favorite haunts. She would stand on the beach and point out freighters crossing the lake to distant ports that only she had dreamed of. His enchantment lasted through the glorious days of August, but began to fade by the end of September when pickings began to run thin at the casino. He could see the writing on the wall. It was time to move on. He saw legions of seagulls from northern Canada heading south, followed by flights of geese. Fuzzy brown caterpillars edged their way along the woodland paths. Mother deer began to chase away their summer fawns, ready to begin again with their newly adult stags. One early morning at the beginning of October, he boarded the ferry and headed back to Sandusky. He didn't even say goodbye. He was in a casino in Detroit when they found him. He had been certain that Evangeline's parents would never have the resources to chase him down, but he had underestimated the bond that held the island people together. The wronged parents on their own could do nothing, but a couple of dozen heavily muscled men who worked the limestone quarry and rode the freighters found him before the end of October. They dragged him back to Kelly's Island, making the crossing in the teeth of an autumn gale, and presented him as a prize to Mr. and Mrs. Latimer and their pregnant daughter. He didn't ride the ferry again until early summer, and this time he was not alone. This time he had a wife and a child and no visible means of support, only his wits and his ability to sniff out an opportunity wherever he was. Joshua, May 22, 1923. Evangeline slept, and Joshua watched over her, feeling incredibly protective and relieved. Lying beside her and watching her sleep was perhaps even more rewarding than making love to her. Not that he had anything to complain about. He just wished they hadn't both been so urgent. He would do better next time. He would take his time. He would find out what pleased her, although it seemed that everything had pleased her. She had seemed very pleased. She had seemed overwhelmingly and quite noisily pleased. It had been an amazing experience, and he looked forward to doing it again and again. She woke up long after sunset as a chill wind started to blow through the trees and the boat bobbed impatiently at its mooring rope. She wound her arms around his neck and smiled at him. "Thank you," she said. She wrapped herself in the blanket that had formed their bed and allowed him to lift her into the stern of the boat. He untied the painter, gave the boat a strong push away from the shore, and then scrambled in beside her. He took a moment to get his bearings on the water, and then he put his arm around her shoulders as they traveled together in companionable silence. "About tomorrow," he said. She kissed him, and for a moment he forgot about tomorrow. But later he asked again. "Tomorrow?" he said. "Don't talk about tomorrow," she replied. "Don't spoil today by talking about tomorrow." "Well," he said, "it's just that things are different now." She smiled again. "Yes, they are," she said. "I suspect that Danny is going to be teasing you unmercifully." "Oh, let him," Joshua replied. "He's just envious." "But what about Nell and Cornelia and everyone else?" "I don't care who knows," Joshua replied. "I want to tell the whole world." She shook her head. "Don't go waking up tonight." "No, of course not. I'll be discreet." "Don't say anything yet," she begged. "I have to think of my boys." "Oh, yes," he said. "I must admit I forgot about your boys." "Sometimes I would like to forget about them too," Evangeline said. "But I can't. So please, don't say anything." "But," Joshua persisted, "about tomorrow." "We'll deal with tomorrow when tomorrow comes," Evangeline said. "Now stop talking about tomorrow, and let's see if we can get ourselves home before I freeze to death." John Murray, May 23, 1923. The riverman was late arriving at the boat shed, and John Murray waited with growing impatience. His boys had told him that Joshua McLaren was usually at work by 7 in the morning, and now it was 9 o'clock. If he had to wait much longer, there was a danger that other people would see him. Reporters, photographers, perhaps even the police. He wasn't ready for that, not yet. He concealed himself in the shadows and lit a cigarette. McLaren's boatyard looked like a prosperous little enterprise, obviously the result of several generations of honest labor. Not the kind of work that would interest John Murray. Joshua McLaren appeared at last, striding happily down the road with a smile on his face, whistling in tune with the all-pervading bird song and looking up at the sunshine with approval. He unlocked the door to the main shed and called out in an exceptionally thunderous voice, "Danny! Danny!" There was no sign of anyone called Danny. "Now where is he?" Joshua said, and he went inside, still whistling. John quietly followed and watched as he pulled a large wooden barrel out into the work area. So that was it. He'd seen the pictures in the newspaper, of course, but not the genuine article. As a barrel, it was a sturdy item. As a boat, it left a lot to be desired. The barrel had been decorated with slogans. "Over the Falls for Freedom," "Evangeline Murray, American Heroine," "Down with Male Control, Up with Birth Control." John Murray smiled at the last slogan. Birth control would have made his life much easier. Joshua McLaren circled around the barrel, still whistling, and then he gave it a mighty kick with his work boot. He slapped the top of it, circled around, and kicked it again. John had absolutely no idea what the man was doing, but it seemed as good a moment as any to interrupt him. He stepped forward into the light. "Good morning," he said. Joshua looked up, surprised. "No interviews," he grunted. John laughed. "I'm not a reporter." "Do I look like a reporter?" "You all look the same to me," Joshua replied. "Do you want something?" "I want to ask you about Mrs. Murray." "I can't tell you anything about her," the Canadian said, but he seemed to be smiling, and John thought it would not be hard to get him to talk. "You should be talking to her agent. She's up the road at the house. Just ask for Miss Braithwaite." "But you're the, shall we say, technical expert," John said. "Aye, you could say that." "I see. Care for a cigarette?" "No." John Murray decided that the riverman was just as Jeremy and Frank had described him, no more and no less. He was powerfully built, competent, and supremely uncommunicative. John concluded that he might best the Canadian at poker, but he'd have to be out of his mind to go up against him in any kind of physical combat. Beneath the apparently calm exterior, there was a wealth of passion which would make him a powerful enemy. "The launch is tomorrow, then?" John asked. "Mayhap. And she's not likely to change her mind." Joshua looked at him, and John Murray, who made a living by reading the faces of strangers, knew that he had struck a chord. "Women change their minds sometimes," Joshua said. "Women are a mystery." John's brain was furiously working out the best way to play McLaren. That wasn't the original plan, but this one might be better. Definitely a prosperous little business. McLaren was a Scotsman, one of a thrifty breed. There'd be money stashed away somewhere. "What are her chances of surviving the ride?" John asked. "I cannot say," he replied, "but I can say that the chances for anyone are very small indeed. I've seen a lot of people die in these waters, and I've only seen two survive the falls." "So a barrel doesn't make a very good boat," John said. "It's a fool's game," Joshua replied. "I don't know why anyone would want to do it, and certainly not someone like..." He stopped, shrugged his shoulders, and pulled a pipe out of his pocket. So that was it, John thought, straight from the horse's mouth. He had a decision to make. He knew there was big money in this enterprise, but what was the most profitable way to go about it? Should he wait until she'd gone over the falls and then come forward and share in her success? He'd planned to tell the press that he had amnesia as a result of his fall from the ferry. It would be impossible to prove him a liar. With the money Evangeline would be bringing in for personal appearances, they'd be set for life. He'd soon have Cornelia Braithwaite out of the picture, and he could take over Evangeline's management himself. That was the original plan. Now he wasn't so sure. His thinking had changed since he had arrived at the falls. He'd seen the falls up close and realized just how risky the plan was. Viewed from a distance, it had sounded like a lark, a piece of fun, It fitted well with the craziness of the world around him, with jazz and moonshine and girls in silly, flirty dresses. It fitted with Evangeline's personality. It was, in fact, ideal for her. She was always looking for something to give meaning to her life. He looked at McLaren again in the light of what the boys had told him last night. McLaren had taken Evangeline out boating, and they had stayed out nearly all night. They had said that McLaren was a miserable old man with a constant frown, but the man he saw before him seemed positively cheerful, and he was showing almost no interest in the barrel. It was as though his mind was elsewhere. Perhaps the barrel was no longer an issue. Maybe she changed her mind. That would be typical of Evangeline. Well, John Murray prided himself on having a plan for every occasion. He extended his hand. "Allow me to introduce myself," he said. "John Murray, at your service." The Canadian straightened up slowly and looked at him. John was uncomfortably aware of the other man's height and bulk. "Who did you say you were?" "John Murray." "Any relation?" There was no need for Joshua to finish the sentence. John was already nodding his head and smiling. "Oh, yes. Definitely a relation." John allowed the silence to stretch out and fill the cavernous boatshed as he watched the thoughts chasing around McLaren's face. "But she told me you were dead," McLaren said eventually.
"I know."
"But you're not dead." It was an obvious statement, hardly worthy of an answer. "No, I'm happy to say I'm not dead."
"I see," said Joshua McLaren.
John continued to assess the Canadian's expression. The man surprised him. He was not shocked. He was not puzzled. He appeared to be simply sad, nothing more. He looked like a man who had suffered terrible losses and expected nothing more from life. Even John was a little moved by the other man's desolation. "I could, of course, remain dead," Murray offered, "so far as the world is concerned. At the time that I died, there were a lot of people looking for me because they fancy that I owe them a trifling sum of money. My death was a very convenient way of getting rid of them. Drowning is so final, you see, and so little evidence is required. After all, the body could be anywhere, couldn't it? Now, do correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the impression that you have more than a business interest in my wife. Or should I continue to say, widow?"
"What do you mean?"
John laughed. "It's my business to read faces," he said, "and yours is an open book. Besides, my sons have already told me that they reckon their mother fancies you."
"They know that you're here?"
"I traveled with them," John said.
"I see," said the Canadian, and John suspected that he saw many things that were not necessarily flattering to the Murray family.
There was a long moment of silence. John waited, knowing that whoever spoke first would be the loser. The riverman broke the silence and lost the contest.
"How could you sink so low?" he asked.
"You make me sick. You and all of your family." John smiled.
"I'm sure we do," he said.
"But really, Mr. McLaren, we need not stay around to bother you. You see, I had been planning to wait until after my wife had completed her daring little escapade and then join with her in reaping the rewards. However, that no longer looks like such a sure thing. I can see that it's a very risky business." He smiled again at the glowering riverman. "You, on the other hand, seem like a certainty." "Oh, yes, I can see which way the wind's blowing, and I know what a nuisance I'd be to you. There would have to be a divorce and all kinds of scandal."
"Scandal?
Another man's wife and all that sort of thing."
"She said she was a widow," Joshua protested.
"But she isn't, is she?" John said in tones of sweet reason. "I wouldn't say that she loves me or that I love her, but we are, in fact, married. You look like a very upright kind of man. I'm guessing you're a Presbyterian. Most of your kind are."
"Leave my church out of this," McLaren said.
"But I can't, can I?" John asked. "If you're wanting to legalize whatever arrangement you chose to make with my wife, there will have to be a divorce." McLaren stared at him. He wondered if he was pushing this a bit too far. Maybe things had not reached that stage between them. Well, it was worth a try.
However, he continued, I would be very happy, indeed, to remain dead, if I could just find a way to pay off some of my debts and remove myself from this continent. Maybe Europe or South America. I'm not asking for much. 10,000 should do it.
10,000?
Oh, you can raise it, John assured him. You have a nice little business here, and you look like a thrifty sort. 10,000 shouldn't be a problem.
I need to think, Joshua said softly. I can't believe that Evangeline would...
He's wondering, John Murray thought, if Evangeline knows about this. I may have overplayed my hand.
Oh, well, now I've started, there's no point in stopping. But I might need a backup plan.
He nodded to McLaren. Think about it, he said. I'll be back tonight. Let's say at 10 o'clock.
He turned towards the door.
Incidentally, he said over his shoulder, cash only. You understand that it's difficult for a dead man to cash a check.
Evangeline
was in her bedroom. There were things that she should have been doing, but she preferred to stay in her room. Cornelia had ordered her to go into town to sign autographs and make a general spectacle of herself, but she had ignored the order. Iris had suggested a trip to the beauty parlor, and Nell had urged that she should at least come down to breakfast, because going hungry never helped anything. Evangeline had paused to admire Nell's drastic new haircut, but remained in bed. The women made frequent trips to her bedroom door to ask her what was wrong, but eventually they left her alone. A little later, she heard the door slam and looked out of the window to see Cornelia, Iris, and Nell headed into town with Danny driving Morag and the cart. Evangeline could guess what they were all thinking. They were thinking that this was her last day, and so she should be allowed to do whatever she wanted. Tomorrow would be soon enough to do what they wanted. She sat on the edge of her bed thinking of Joshua. She had done her best to think of other things. She had thought briefly about the river and the falls, and at length about Jeremy and Frank. They had been in Canada for less than a week, and already they had a couple of run-ins with the Canadian Mounted Police. She spared a thought for John and the part he had played in her life, luring her away from the tedium of Kelly's Island and of all the adventures they had together, and all the fights. But whatever she did, her thoughts came back to Joshua, and there they lingered. She could not and did not want to forget how it felt to lie in the arms of someone she trusted so completely. She thought of the joy they'd found in each other, and how free he'd been with his laughter. If only he hadn't started pressing her about the barrel. She knew what he was thinking. He was thinking that if she had him and the security of his love, she would have no need to fling herself over Niagara Falls. She wanted to be angry the way that Cornelia would have been angry. Why would he assume that she would go back on her word and her contract? Did he really think she would just tell the newspaper reporters and photographers that she had fallen in love with her river pilot and therefore she was giving up the whole adventure? Why would he think that the love of Joshua McLaren be preferable to world fame and immense fortune? And anyway, had she indeed fallen in love with him? She could imagine every scornful word that would come from Cornelia, and she had no answers of her own. Would she still go over the falls? She had no idea. Downstairs, the front door slammed, and Joshua called her name. Evangeline's heart skipped a beat. He was back, and they could face each other in daylight, without the benefit of a bottle of scotch. They would be alone in the house. He could come up to her room. No one would ever know. She smiled to herself. He was already coming, running urgently up the stairs. He pounded on her bedroom door, and she opened it, smiling. Her smile vanished when she saw his face.
"How could you?" he shouted. "How could you? It's all a game to you, isn't it?"
"What do you mean, Joshua? I don't understand." He pushed past her into the room and sat down abruptly on the window seat. He dropped his head into his hands and spoke softly with infinite sadness. "I loved you, lass," he said. "You brought me back to life, and I loved you."
"Joshua," she pleaded, "what's happened? Why are you talking like this?"
"What will you do?" he said. "Will you both take the money and run? You never meant to do it, did you? You fooled everyone. Miss Braithwaite, that poor little Iris, my sister. You fooled us all."
"What money?" she asked.
He looked up at her sadly. You don't have to play the game any longer. He's already called on me to ask for the money.
What did you do? Did you telephone him last night after you got home? Did you tell him the deed was done?
It was done, wasn't it, Evangeline?
He looked away from her. I thought you meant it, he said bitterly. You're quite an actress. You had me fooled.
Acting? Evangeline thought, how could anyone mistake what she had done last night as acting?
She extended her hand cautiously. He turned away.
10,000, he said, in Canadian currency. No checks. If I'd have thought the 10,000 would save your life, I would have given it to you, Evangeline. You wouldn't have to get it out of me with blackmail. I was ready to share everything I have with you. But I'm not sharing it with him.
Evangeline sits down slowly on the edge of the bed. Joshua, she said, what on earth are you talking about?
He looked over to her. I came here to throw you out, he said. I was so angry that I wanted to hurt you. Physically hurt you, but I can't do it. Whoever you are, whatever you do, I can't help loving you. But I'm not playing his little game.
What game? Who's been talking to you?
Wait a minute. Suddenly, Evangeline was sure that she could see the truth.
Jeremy, she said.
That's who it is. Jeremy's been up to one of his tricks, hasn't he?
Joshua shook his head.
Well, then it was Frank, said Evangeline.
Take no notice of them, Joshua. They are their father's sons, and they are beyond my control. What scheme have they cooked up? Whatever it is, I have nothing to do with them.
She rose to her feet.
I'll sort them out, she said. I'll go right now and sort them out.
And your husband, said Joshua, will you sort him out too?
She sank down again on the edge of the bed, her knees suddenly weak, while her face registered disbelief. A little voice inside her said,
Yes, yes, I told you so.
John, she said weakly, John's dead.
That's what you told me, Joshua replied coldly. But drowning is such a convenient death, isn't it? No need for a body. All you need are a couple of witnesses, and your sons made such good witnesses, didn't they? I think you should have been there yourself. You're the real actress in the family, and the grieving widow is so much more convincing.
John's dead, Evangeline repeated, numb with shock.
John is here in Niagara Falls, said Joshua. He just visited me. For $10,000, he's willing to abandon his resurrection and take himself off to Europe or South America.
John? Here? Evangeline repeated weakly.
Joshua rose to his feet. Turn it off, Evangeline. Turn off the performance. I may not be as sophisticated as you and your husband, but I'm not a complete fool. You'll not get a penny from me. Not you or your husband. You'll have to find some other way to get yourselves to South America.
Joshua, Evangeline pleaded, don't go, I swear to you.
Don't swear, he said. Don't waste your breath. Goodbye, Mrs. Murray. He slammed the door so hard behind him that the house shook.